Good morning, everyone. I would like to start thanking Alain for organizing this beautiful meeting. I think the topics are really diverse, but also well connected. So I'm looking forward to the rest of this meeting. So I'm going to switch topic a little bit, although a lot of the molecular things James is talking about are going to get back in my seminar. So I'll focus on the developing nervous system. And the subject of our studies is depicted here, and this is a dissected human nervous system. It took two grad students about 4 years together to remove everything from this corpse, the muscles and the bones and all the other tissues, except for the nerves. And what you're left with is a very, I think, complicated nervous system comprised of billions of neurons. They're all different connections, different neurotransmitters. They can have long axons, short axons, and they're to a certain extent all unique. They make unique turns, they have unique synaptic partners. And I think the largest problem is that they more or less form all together. They encounter each other, they try to avoid each other, or they grow alongside. So again, imagine that you need a very sophisticated set of cellular processes to get this nervous system, and some of them are listed here. So of course, first you need neurons. They need to migrate to the place they have their position in the brain or spinal cord. They form neurites, axons, and dendrites. These grow, and then these are guided to the right location in other part of the brain or outside the brain. And often axons fasciculate into bundles. They innervate their target and form a synapse. So of course, these processes are all regulated by very complicated molecular mechanisms. And for one of these mechanisms and processes, I will talk today, axon guidance. So we're interested in how axon guidance works, but not only because of a basic interest, but also because of links to disease. A lot of the proteins I was listing, also the processes, are linked to, for example, autism and schizophrenia, which are, of course, developmental disorders, but there's also no evidence that defects in axon guidance proteins are linked to the development of epilepsy, and evidence is accumulating that also neurodegenerative disorders like ALS are also to a certain extent linked to defects in axon guidance, or at least axon guidance proteins. So in my lab, we're trying to do two things. First of all, we're trying to research how axons develop. So what kind of cues do you need to get an axon from A to B? What kind of cues are involved, and how do these cues work, how are they detected? And on the other hand, we're investigating two disorders, epilepsy and ALS, in which axons are either lost in ALS or in which they are rearranged, like in epilepsy. And we try to connect these two research topics, so we try to use the fundamental biology information we obtain in disease and also vice versa. But today I will talk about axon guidance. And axon guidance is a process in which the axon gets information from molecular cues in the environment to get to its final target. And there are different axon guidance proteins. They can either be secreted in the environment by glial cells and fibroblasts and other neurons and form gradients. And they can either attract or repel growing axons. And then there are also guidance cues in the membrane, either transmembrane or GPI linked. They function on a short range, for example, to funnel axons together in bundles or to act as a growth substrate. And a very important structure to detect these cues is the growth cone. And you can actually see it here. So it's a hand-like structure. Also, James referred to it already several times. It's at the end of the axon, which is here. And this is actually a clump of neurons. You see the cell bodies. In this experiment, a tissue culture dish was coated with two proteins. One is attractive and one is repulsive, and you see the border here, and these are two other neurons. And this is actually a movie, and what you will see is that this growth cone will start to grow, it will sample the environment, and will make a decision. So you see it grow, it extends these spikes, these filopodia, it's actually sampling even the inhibitory repulsive environment, but eventually it will retract and decide to stay in the stimulatory attractive environment and maybe even make a connection eventually with this other neuron. So when an axon grows in our brain, these kinds of decisions are taking place all the time. Work during the past, I would say 25 years, has led to the identification of five major families of axon guidance proteins, afferents and Fs. Netrin DCC, Semaphore, and Plexins, and some others, and they're listed here. And the process I explained to you just yet is long-range exon guidance, but it's good to know that exon guidance proteins are also involved, for example, in exon fasciculation, topographic mapping, and also self-avoidance. So they're regulating different processes during development. So we're studying these proteins in different ways, and one large objective in the lab is to generate reporter mice in which we can visualize subsets of neurons. And that is because a lot of neuronal systems, and I depicted here the dopamine system in the midbrain labeled with TH in red, it's actually comprised of neuronal subsets with different functions. For example, the substantia nigra projects to the dorsal striatum and controls motor behavior, and the ventral tegmental area neurons project to other brain regions and, for example, control cognition. But typically people use tyrosine hydroxylase to label all neurons, and they can't distinguish between these neuronal subsets. So we now have made mice using subtractive genetics approaches in which actually the substantia nigra neurons are labeled in green, and you can see their axons in the dorsal striatum. So we're now able to, for the first time, see specifically how do these dopaminergic neurons develop. And you can see that it's still a bit dense, so there are a lot of labeled neurons in the substantia nigra, so we also generated lines in which actually substantia nigra neurons are labeled, but they're only sparsely labeled, so we can also actually look at the dendrites of these neurons at the level of the midbrain. And I think even more interestingly, we can look at the termination fields of single neurons in the striatum. Another part of our work concerns with how exon guidance cues work and how they are detected, and a lot of what we do focuses on semaphorins. And semaphorin are depicted here, so it's a large family of proteins, or 8 subfamilies, and they can be secreted, transmembrane, and also GPI linked. And they use, in neurons at least, a receptor complex which almost always contains plexins. Like plexins are large transmembrane proteins. So plexins are proteins that bind sometimes semaphorins and transfer the signal into the growth cone. And in certain situations, plexins need accessory proteins like neuropilins for ligand binding. And today I will mainly talk about this subclass of semaphorins, the class 1. These are transmembrane semaphorins. They bind plexin A and induce signaling. And these are found in invertebrates like the fruit fly. In addition, I will talk about class 3 semaphorins. They are secreted. They bind the receptor complex also composed of plexin A's, like SEMA1A, but they require neuropilins for ligand binding and also IgCAMs to determine the signaling outcome, be it attraction or repulsion. So there's a lot of research going on in the lab. For example, we're interested in how semaphorins are cleaved and released from the membrane, so how transmembrane semaphorins can also work over a distance. We see sometimes that the same semaphorin can act as a repellent but also as an attractant, so we're interested how does this work, what kind of cues are regulating this conversion, and what is the signaling that you need. And also we're investigating a process called bidirectional signaling, and this is when a transmembrane semaphorin not only is a ligand but also is a receptor, so binds actually its normal receptor but then signals into the growth cone. For today, I will take a little step back in time, and that was when I started my postdoc in the lab of Al Skolotkin, back then in Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. Back then, actually, a lot of guidance cues had been identified, including the semaphorins, so we knew which semaphorins are there, which receptors are present in the growth cone, but what we didn't really know is how does this receptor connect to the cytoskeleton, so after ligand binding, what happens in the growth cone that induces these changes in the cytoskeleton that allows a growth cone to steer. So we set up an experiment together with John Thurman in the lab, a postdoc, to begin to identify proteins that would bind the cytoplasmic portion of this receptor, this plexin. We did a yeast to hybrid experiment, and we found a protein called Michael. It just had been identified as a molecule interacting with Cas-L, which is a protein, for example, involved in integrin signaling. We generated an antibody and stained the nervous system of a fruit fly embryo. And this is actually a fillet preparation in which you open up the embryo. And what you see here is basically what we call we could call the spinal cord of this embryo. So you see motor neurons here in brown, and this is actually an axon. So MICO seems to be in the right location. It's in neurons, it's in axons, and also in growth cones in vivo. Using immunoprecipitation techniques, we could also show that MICO and plexin physically interact, so we could co-purify them from fruit flies. And then John also generated a fruit fly lacking MICO. So in this fruit fly embryo, there was no MICO. And here again, this is a normal wild type fruit fly, in which here would be this midline structure, this spinal cord. This is a nerve bundle. And in wild type flies, it makes a branch here, and for example, also here, to innervate these structures. And these are the muscles of the abdomen. And then these fibers would make synapses to control these muscles. However, if you look at MICO mutants, you see the nerve bundle growing into the periphery, but you don't see these branches. So these muscles are not innervated. And these phenotypes you will also observe when you remove plexin or the ligand semaphorin 1A. And we could also show in transheterozygous experiments that these genes genetically interact. So I think we provided evidence that MICOs bind plexins and that they were required for signaling both in vivo. So MICOs are actually very interesting proteins. So the fly MICO was about 4,000 amino acids. So it took John 1 year to clone it, because he started with this part here, which is the part of MICO that binds plexin, and then he cloned his way towards the end. In addition to this C-terminal part, which in addition to plexins also bind RAPs with the B, fimentin, and some other proteins. It has proline-rich regions, for example, which bind Cas-L, a LIM domain, which binds CRMP, a component homology domain, and then, I think, most interestingly, an enzyme at the end, a flavor enzyme. And I will come back to this in a second. The slide is a little bit fuzzy, but actually, when we started to look in literature, we found that this is the fly MICO, which is very large, that in humans and also in other vertebrates, there were three vertebrate MICOs, 1, 2, and 3, and they have the same domain structure, so also this enzyme and the additional domains, but they vary in length a little bit, but they seem very similar. In addition, we also identified two MICOs that have all the domains except for the enzyme, and we call them MICO-likes. We focused on the full-length proteins and did several experiments to show that these proteins are also expressed in the nervous system. So these are northern blots showing that especially MICO 1 and 3 are strongly expressed in development and also adulthood. And by doing RT-PCR, we show the same. So expression from E15 to adulthood for MICO 1 and 3, and MICO 2 seems to come up later, at least at the RNA level. And C-type hybridizations in the adult rat shows a similar picture. So you have MICO 1, MICO 3 expression very broadly in different structures like the cortex and the hippocampus, and MICO 2 seems to be a little bit more restricted and also weaker. Interestingly, for all the regeneration people here, we also did an extensive study on the expression profiles in the injured spinal cord, and we find that MICOs are actually very strongly expressed in the meningeal scar and also in oligodendrocytes around the injury site, all three members actually, so 1, 2, and 3. And you can see here the meningeal fibroblasts, and I don't have a picture actually of the oligodendrocytes. So when we started to look into the structure of MICO, we noted a couple of motifs at the end, at the beginning, at the N-terminal part of the protein. And these motifs turn out to be FAD binding motifs. So these different motifs bind different parts of an FAD molecule. And these are characteristics of a flavoprotein monooxygenase, also known as hydroxylase. And these enzymes, they use FAD as an electron donor to insert an atom of oxygen in a substrate. And oftentimes these are small molecules, but in some cases these also can be, for example, actin, small GTPases, and also GAP43, which of course raised our interest, because actin is a really important downstream protein in semaphorin signaling. So to really confirm that this is actually a true enzyme, we collaborated with Yvonne Jones and Christian Siebold at Oxford University to generate a crystal structure of this enzyme, so the N-terminal part only, which is about 500 amino acids. And you can indeed see that you, if you make the structure, that this FAD molecule is present in the structure, and that it can change the conformation in an NADPH-dependent manner. So it can either be inside the structure or move to a cavity, which then opens up. And this is interesting because when you take several known monooxygenases and you put them on top of each other, they look very similar. I depicted here them here in different colors. And this is again the FAD molecule. And these are a couple of small molecule substrates of the other monooxygenases. But this is Michael. So you can see Michael here in green. And the FAD molecule is pointing outwards to a cavity here, which may be a pocket for a larger molecule, like a protein. But first, to confirm that this whole monooxygenase enzyme aspect is important for exon guidance, what John did is he generated a fly with a mutated monooxygenase domain. So he mutated these glycines into tryptophanes, which would render the enzyme inactive. Then he would cross the loss of function fly without Michael with a transgenic fly expressing full-length Michael, or one that was expressing this mutant. And what we see is that when we use wild type, we can rescue, but when we use an enzymatically inactive form, there is no rescue. So this, at least the integrity of this domain is important for exon guidance. Interestingly, John continued to pursue his own studies and is now at UT Southwestern. And I think he did a very interesting finding, actually showing that actin is a substrate for Michael. So Michael is able to oxidize actin at a specific methionine at the pointed end of an actin subunit. And this causes severing of actin polymers and their disassembly. And of course, this fits in the picture of semaphorin signaling, by which a semaphorin binding to a plexin would activate Michael, leading to actin depolymerization and growth cone collapse or stirring. Another study by Morinaka and colleagues shows that Michael may be able to control two components of our cytoskeleton, not only actin, but also microtubules. So in the absence of a substrate, Michael will produce H2O2, and this will allow crimp, which is a tubulin polymerization factor, to form dimers. This dimerization then allows another protein, tyroredoxin, to bind, and this binding is important for the phosphorylation of CRIMP2 by DSK3-beta. And this leads to an inactivation of CRIMP2 and a inhibition of polymerization, and this is another thing you see during growth cone collapse. So Michael has the capacity to directly regulate actin through oxidation and indirectly regulate microtubule dynamics. Going back to plexins, of course, we had pretty solid evidence that Michael was involved in plexin signaling in the fruit fly, but we wondered, is this also the case in vertebrates? And there were several pieces of data by us and also our colleagues suggesting that this would be the case. So we found that all three Michaels bind this plexin A's, A4 to A1 to A4, that Michaels and plexins in vertebrate neurons are co-expressed, so they're at the same moment in the same place. That if you would induce knockdown of Michael 1 or Michael 3, you could block the repulsive effects of SEMA3A, at least in culture. So to address this question, we made knockout mice in collaboration with Alice Kolotkin for two Michaels, Michael 1 and Michael 3, because these are the most abundant during development, and used these mice to see whether there are any defects present. And of course, especially defects that you would also find in plexin mice or in semaphorin mice. And we did, for example, hole mount stainings for neurofilament in embryos to look at peripheral nerves, which are often disturbed in plexin mutants. We tested whether the sensitivity of a growth cone to a particular semaphorin would change if you would remove MICO, which you would expect because you would perturb signaling. And actually, we did a lot of studies about which I could also probably talk for half an hour, but we found nothing. So there were no defects in this mouse, which in the single knockouts, but also in the MICO 1-3 double knockout, which would give the suggestion that there is a link to plexin signaling. So at the moment, we're studying this further by generating the MICO 2 knockout, which may be a redundant factor. So we have this knockout now, and we're generating triple knockout mice to see whether this is solving the problem. However, luckily, when we were investigating these mice, we noted a defect in the hippocampus and decided to pursue this defect a little bit further. So we looked at the mossy fiber axons, which are the axons of dentin gyrus granule cells here in the hippocampus, and they form the mossy fiber pathway. And there are actually two bundles, the suprapyramidal bundle and the infrapyramidal bundle. And these bundles grow on top or below the pyramidal neurons of CA3. So they grow above the cell bodies, and they either contact the apical or the basal dendrites and synapse there. When we do immunohistochemistry using an antibody that we made in the lab, we can also see that indeed MICO1 is present in these granule cells and also in the axons, the mossy fiber axons. So it seems to be in the right place to have a role in this system. And indeed, so if you now look at a higher magnification of these mossy fibers, you can see here this suprapyramidal bundle, this infrapyramidal bundle, the cell bodies of CA3 pyramidal neurons, and normally there are only very few axons crossing over from one to the other bundle. It's nearly empty. However, when you remove MICO1, you can see that now many axons are crossing over, that the lamination of this structure is lost. And also, when you use synaptoporin, which is a marker for mossy fiber synapses, you can see that there are actually now synapses in this region. So the mossy fibers are now forming synapses on the cell bodies, it seems, of these pyramidal neurons. And to really confirm this, we generated animals in which a couple of these CA3 pyramidal neurons was visualized with GFP using a Taiwan GFP mouse into a MICO1 deficient background. And this is the wild type situation. So these are basal dendrites. This is an apical dendrite. This is the cell body. And we looked very carefully, but we actually never find any dendritic spines or somatic spines on these neurons in the wild type situation. However, when we now look in the mutant, you see these gigantic spines occurring. And when we do co-stains, we also see synaptoporin on these spines. So it seems that now these axons are able to make synapses on spines. And they're kind of gigantic, but this is actually also the case of the normal spines that would occur at the apical dendrite. And then we used electron microscopy to show that indeed these structures were dendrites. And we stained the pyramidal neuron here in greenish yellow. You can see the cell body. And then here a spine is extending. And we did immuno staining for synaptoporin. And you see a lot of positive postsynaptic density suggesting that these are synapses. However, as I indicated to you earlier, we didn't have any evidence that there was a link to plexin. So how are MICOs regulating the lamination of the hippocampus? So what we did, and we used this strategy previously, is we micro-dissected the pyramidal neuron layer, so this layer, using laser capture microscopy, because we thought there may be cues that normally keep out the mossy fibers from the pyramidal neuron layer. So we collected these pieces of tissue and did proteomics mass spec analysis on this tissue. And we found a lot of interesting proteins enriched. First of all, a lot of proteins involved in transport, like, for example, RAP11 was mentioned previously, but also GDI1, which is a protein that regulates the activity of RAP proteins. And actually, these mice, these GDI1 mice, have a similar phenotype in the hippocampus as MICO1 mice. We also found a lot of cell adhesion molecules, and again, for example, NCAM mice have the similar phenotype as MICO1 mice, so they also have this defective lamination. So to study whether there is a link between Michael deficiency and IgCAMs like NCAM and CHL1, again, which also show these defects when you knock them out, we looked first at the expression level of NCAM, it's actually PSA NCAM, or CHL1 in the wild-type hippocampus. So here again, the suprapyramidal bundle, infrapyramidal bundle, and these sections were treated with triton, so you see all protein present, and you don't really see a difference between wild-type and knockout for both proteins. However, when you would not use triton, only look at cell surface protein in these sections, you would see that now levels are reduced, both for PSA NCAM and also for CHL1. And we confirmed this doing fractionation, so we made fractions of the cytoplasm or the cell membrane, and then we find for CHL1 that there seems to be an accumulation in the cytoplasm and a decrease at the cell surface, and this is also true for L1 and other IgCAMs, but for example not for an plexin D1. So what Michael seems to do is it seems to regulate the cell surface levels of certain proteins, in this case IgCAMs. Like I said, the CHL1 knockout and also the NCAM1 knockout have the similar phenotypes with respect to lamination as the Michael1 knockout, but the heterozygous animals don't show these phenotypes in our hands. So we did a trans-heterozygous experiment in which we crossbred heterozygous animals for NCAM, CHL1 or Michael1, and then looked whether we could detect a phenotype, and indeed we can. So in normal heterozygous, lamination is fine infrapyramidal bundle, suprapyramidal bundle, but when you make double heterozygous mice, you can see that there are now a lot of exons in between the cell bodies. So this proves basically that at the genetic level, Michael1 and NCAM and Michael1 and CHL1 interact. In sections, we observed that cell surface levels of PSA NCAM were increased, and that and also in the biochemistry we found that internal level seems to be increased of PSA NCAM. We also checked this in the growth cones of hippocampal neurons, so we dissociated hippocampal neurons, and after a couple of days we added an antibody against PSA NCAM and allowed it to be internalized, and then looked at internal PSA NCAM, and you can see that indeed in the Michael1 knockout it's increased. But if you would take a neuron, stain it, and only stain the outside, you can see that cell surface levels are decreased. And this is in line with the section stainings and also the biochemistry. Interestingly, of course, there could be several reasons why a cell surface protein is on the is expressed at reduced levels on the cell surface. But we knew from previous studies that Michaels are linked to Rep proteins, and as you heard previously from James, Reps are really important for trafficking, recycling, etc. of proteins. We have shown previously in collaboration with Anna Akhmanova in Utrecht that, for example, Michael3 regulates Rep6 vesicle trafficking, and Rep6 is a cargo vesicle that transports protein from the Golgi to the membrane, also the growth cone. So we first examined whether NCAM, Michael1 and Rep6 would co-localize, and indeed we see that there is NCAM Michael1 in Rep6 positive vesicles. So these proteins are localizing together to these vesicles that are being transported in the cell. So one idea could be that these vesicles never make it or that they're not released, and therefore that you have reduced cell surface expression if you don't have Michael. So to look at the vesicles, we combined an F-actin staining to visualize the actin cytoskeleton, also because Michael, like I explained to you previously, has a role in actin polymerization, and Rep6 signaling. So this is endogenous Rep6. And we find that normally you have this F-actin, it's distributed more or less equally in the growth cone, with the exception of a few large bundles. And also there is some Rep6, you probably even can't see it at this magnification, but if you compare it to the mutant growth cones, you can see there is now an accumulation of actin in the central domain of the growth cone, close to the axon, and this is also where a lot of Rep6 vesicles are now. So it seems that they are accumulating in the central domain of the growth cone. And of course, it could be that due to this accumulation, they never make it to the cell membrane, and they will never be able to release their content and insert these IgCAMs into the membrane. Like I said, like I told you previously, Michael is able to regulate the actin cytoskeleton, and we wanted to test whether this accumulation of RAB6 vesicles in the growth cone was related to the monooxygenase-driven actin effects of Michael. So what we did is we cultured hippocampal neurons, we transfected them with GFP, or with full-length Michael, or with this Michael mutant unable to use its N-terminal enzyme, this flavoprotein monooxygenase. And in wild-type neurons, you see that there is a very nice distribution of RAB6 vesicles throughout the growth cone. And it doesn't really change if you overexpress wild-type Michael. However, in mutant neurons, you see this accumulation of RAB6 vesicles here. And you can actually rescue this by putting back the wild-type protein. So you now again get a distribution that's more homogeneous, and it's also quantified here. However, when you use a Michael, full-length Michael protein that is unable to function as an enzyme and probably also unable to regulate the actin cytoskeleton, you can't rescue, suggesting that Michael through the cytoskeleton affects RAB6 vesicles. Now finally, to also show that the actin cytoskeleton is the problem, we did a similar experiment. But now we cultured wild-type and mutant neurons in the absence or presence of latrunculin, which is an actin depolymerizing agent, because we figured if we would get rid of this accumulation of actin, maybe the RAB6 vesicles would come free and would be able to release their content. And you can see that indeed in mutant neurons, you see an accumulation of RAB6 vesicles, a little bit of latrunculin, has a small effect, and if you increase the dosage, you get a normalization of the distribution of RAB6 vesicles as you compare it to control. So altogether, we think that the following happens, that you normally have RAB6 vesicles. They contain IgCAMs like NCAM, and they're destined for the cell membrane, where they have a function, for example, in the lamination of the hippocampus. We know that Michael-1 is also on these vesicles, and Michael-1 may have a role in organizing the actin cytoskeleton as these vesicles are transported. If you miss Michael, vesicles are accumulating, they don't reach the cell membrane, there is not enough NCAM, and you get the lamination defects that I told you about. I would like the following people, of course, Alex and John for the initial studies I mentioned, Yvonne Jones and Christian Siebold for collaboration on the crystal structure, Anna Akmanova and Kasper Hogeraad for the RAB6 work, Melita Schachner for providing us tools to study NCAM and CHL1, Barbara Brechtman and Philip Popovich for the regeneration work I showed, and Jan van Weering and Joke Wortel for the EM and EM data I showed, and of course, all the funding agencies for their financial support. And last but not least, I would like to point out that most of this work was done by Elio van Battum, a grad student in my lab, in collaboration with two other grad students, Yeping Zhao and Ruafsa Gunput, who already left the lab to pursue postdoc careers. And finally, I would like to make a little advertisement for the summer school that we're organizing every year. So when you're interested in neural circuit development, please pass by in Utrecht in the summer and take part in this course. So thank you very much for your attention.